I want to begin by apologizing for my temerity in thinking that I can say anything new and interesting with regard to the South China Sea, but I will try to do that. And I want to say three things. I want to talk about three topics. I want to talk about strategy, I want to talk about ASEAN, and I want to talk about China. First, with regard to strategy, without going through a long, you know, a discursus as to what strategy is or isn't, I would suffice it to say that the bottom line, the essential definition of strategy is that there is a goal and there is a means to achieve the goal, right? A desired outcome and a way of making that outcome happen. And I want to talk about this a little bit, not first of all, with regard to China, because I'll talk about China later. Obviously, one cannot talk about the South China Sea without talking about China, and I will do that, but I'll do that later. I want to start with the question, do the countries of Southeast Asia, the individual 10 members of ASEAN, Timor-Leste, do they have strategies with regard to the South China Sea? Now, this is kind of an embarrassing question because someone might say, well, you know, they border more or less the South China Sea. Of course they have strategies. But I'm not sure that that necessarily follows. In order to have a strategy about something, it has to be really important to you. How important is the South China Sea to Laos, which doesn't even have a coastline? The importance of the South China Sea to Laos, of course, it does exist, but it's mediated through the roles that others are playing, whether it's China, the US, ASEAN. So I think one begins by wondering what kind of consciousness of the importance of the South China Sea exists in Southeast Asia, sometimes referred to as, you know, maritime awareness, right? I'm not sure. I will say this, that if you leave the South China Sea aside for just a moment and ask a different question, which are the countries in Southeast Asia that are the most strategic, without, of course, going into the details of what strategic might mean? I think one candidate would immediately spring to mind, and that's Singapore. As far as I know, no other country in Southeast Asia has a unit in the Prime Minister's office assigned to predict the future. Not only would Singapore then have a strategy with regard to the current situation, but the strategy would go into the future. Well, you know, how do we know what the future is going to bring? Well, that's why they have this unit in the Prime Minister's office. So that's extraordinary. That's a very explicit commitment to strategy. Moving to Vietnam. Vietnam has a strategy in the South China Sea and is very strategic more generally. I would argue, and perhaps some of you in the audience would challenge me, but I would say that of all the countries in Southeast Asia, has been tested century after century, right? Millennia, because of their relationship with China. So of any country in Southeast Asia, arguably Vietnam is the most likely to have a strategy with regard to China because it's located right on China's doorstep. And China matters tremendously. We remember 1979, China crossed the border, invaded Vietnam. I'm not saying that's going to happen again. But you might even sort of draw from this the notion that the insecurity that a country feels is a prompt, a reason why that country should have a strategy. Now, arguably, the insecurity has to be optimal. Take Singapore, for example, which I think, if I may say so, there are Singapore diplomats present to whom I apologize in advance, but my sense of it is that actually the leadership in Singapore, to some extent, has exaggerated the insecurity of Singapore, precisely because they want the population of Singapore to acquiesce in the critical decisions that the elite in Singapore feels it necessary to make. This goes all the way back to Lee Kuan Yew. Now, Vietnam obviously has insecurity with regard to China. They also have experience, and again, this historic commitment to Vietnamese identity, right? Third country, and then I'll move on to ASEAN, the Philippines. Some would say that the Philippines does not have a strategy because Duterte doesn't have a strategy. The argument would run something like, Duterte doesn't really care that much about the South China Sea. He doesn't care much about foreign policy. What he cares about is wiping out drug dealers in the streets and also developing the Philippine economy, you know? And so perhaps one could say that if he has any strategy, let's call it, to invent a phrase, strategic fatalism. The fatalism would be that he perhaps thinks, and if you read his statements, I think this would correspond more or less to reality, that China is too powerful to oppose. China is going to dominate the South China Sea, whether we like it or not. And accepting that fatalistic position, the best we can do, our strategy, is to try to get some recompense for our acquiescence. In this case, particularly economic support for infrastructure, for example, in the Philippines. Okay, now I don't have time to talk about other countries in Southeast Asia, but that will at least give you an idea of how one might look at the issue of strategy, not in connection with what China is thinking and doing, but how the Southeast Asian states themselves are reacting or developing their own initiatives with regard to the South China Sea. Okay, now if we're talking about strategy, one of the most obvious adages, right, sort of banal remarks that one can think of as far as strategy is concerned, is the famous dictum, united we stand, divided we fall. United we stand, divided we fall. ASEAN has 10 members. They could be united, they could be divided. If they're united, they stand up against China, for example, if they wish to do that, or they could stand up against the United States or some other country. But lacking that kind of internal unity and cohesion, all they can do is fall victim to outside powers that will manipulate the disunity inside ASEAN to their advantage. Now, this is a harsh remark for me to make. I'm old enough to remember the birth of ASEAN. ASEAN has done terrific things, wonderful things. No two members of ASEAN, we know this, people repeat it constantly, have ever gone to war with each other. One could go on. The economic benefit of being in ASEAN, the trade arrangements, although badly damaged, mind you, by the fallout from COVID-19, I'm sorry to say, and also from the potential conflict, economic conflict between China and the United States. So maybe I shouldn't complain that ASEAN doesn't really have a strategy on the South China Sea. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they really do. But if they do, I don't see it. What kind of strategy might emerge? And I'll get into the reasons why when I talk about China, because I think the role of China in the South China Sea has played a tremendous role in preventing ASEAN. I'm sorry to my colleagues from perhaps the Chinese embassy who might be here. I apologize for that, but that is my own personal view. So what might an ASEAN strategy look like? Well, first of all, it seems to me that one ought to begin with the notion of what is the problem. This is another approach to strategy, not a goal and then a means to achieve that goal, but a problem that the strategy is designed to solve. It's a little different way of approaching the topic of strategy. In my conversations with academic colleagues and diplomats and so forth with regard to the South China Sea, I tend to divide the people I talk to into two categories. One are those who are most worried about escalation, specifically escalation between the United States and China, and then those who are most worried about expansion. And I'm not talking about, you know, Bruneian expansion, or the expansion of any country in Southeast Asia. And I'm not talking about American expansion in any kind of military sense. I think it is entirely implausible, completely implausible, absolutely out of the question, to think that there's anyone in the United States right now, including the person in the White House, who has any ambition to control the South China Sea, to expand, you know, some sort of imperium in the 21st century to take control of the South China Sea. That is absurd. It's completely implausible. It is not implausible, however, with regard to Chinese strategy, or to be more careful, the strategy of the People's Republic of China under the leadership of Xi Jinping in the South China Sea. And at the risk of taking too much time, let me just say a few things in that regard. The question, does China have a strategy, has to be answered, yes, it does have a strategy. One aspect of strategy is that something is consistently attempted so that the goal becomes clear. It's not just, well, maybe Thursday we'll try this. That's a good idea, we'll get that done. And then maybe Monday we'll go to some other objective. No, it seems to me clear from my reading of both previous and current history, that China wishes to control the South China Sea. And that is their goal. I would even go so far as to say, and forgive me, I hope this doesn't sound arrogant on my part, as an academic, I should always realize how much I do not know and not pretend to have answers to questions that are still unanswered. But the question, what does China want in the South China Sea, in my humble opinion, has been answered. It is an obsolete question. China wants control. Now, immediately the question arises, what do we mean by control? What do we mean by control? We can mean a lot of different things. For simplicity's sake, let me distinguish two kinds of control, and I would appreciate any sort of critical response during the Q&A to these ideas. The first category one might call positive control. Positive in the sense that it would be a situation in which absolutely nothing happened in the South China Sea that was not entirely the cause of China. This, it seems to me, is technically inconceivable. Despite the advances in technology, the advance of all manner of methods of control using the internet, using electronic means, such as the means that we're using right now, nevertheless, that is absurd. There will not come a time in which even the tiniest little detail of an event must be attributed to China and to China alone. So I don't think that China wants to establish that kind of positive control over the South China Sea, if only because they're too smart and they know that it can't be done. Now, positive control stands in contrast to a different kind of control, which I would call negative control. What do I mean by negative control? By negative control, what I mean is that there will be no challenge coming from Southeast Asia or from anyone operating in the South China Sea to something that China feels strongly about. Or if there is such a challenge, it will not succeed. Now, remember that there will be many, 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 many things that China doesn't really feel that strongly about. So there will be some freedom to move and maneuver and have choices and whatnot, limited though it may be. But when it comes to the core interests of China, defined in a broader sense than they are currently defined, not just sort of territorial interests, but behavioral, you know, that if you behave in this way, you are as I hear often when I go to conferences with Chinese diplomats, you are hurting the feelings of, you know, billions of Chinese. As if that were truly the case, which I doubt. So you see what I'm saying? They want control, but they're realistic enough to know that they cannot have total or complete control. So the next question, and hopefully the last, so I can leave you some time to respond, because that's what I really look forward to doing, responding to your responses, is to look at some of the tactics, the techniques, the methods of control, which it seemed to me amount to overwhelming evidence of the desire for control. I've got eight of them, and I will not put you to sleep by going through all of the eight, but I will run through them in advance, knowing that I'm not gonna be able to deal with all of them. I'm only gonna be able to deal with a few of them. These are the tactics. Annexation, augmentation, right? That is through terraforming, as it were, right? You dredge the ocean floor and you enlarge the land features, okay? Construction, building facilities. Militarization, introducing weaponry and the capacity to launch weapons. Then intimidation. Some of you undoubtedly did manage to hear Greg Poling 12 days ago in a similar arrangement. And he went into great detail with regard to intimidation, so I don't really need to do that. The intimidation of other countries, especially countries that are challenging China's effort to control the South China Sea. Next, co-optation. And finally, prolongation. Let me just pick a couple. Annexation, the history is obvious, starting 1974, the Paracels, 1988, part of the Spratlys, 1995, Mischief Reef, 2012, Scarborough Shoal. I'll leave it at that. I could go on, but I won't. Augmentation, that sort of goes without saying. We all know what happened. You probably know, again, more about all this than I do. Construction, yes. Militarization, also yes. Intimidation, yes, but Greg covered it, so I won't. So let me just concentrate briefly on ambiguation. Ambiguation, it's an odd term. What does it mean? It means being vague about something on purpose, intentionally vague about something, a tactic to achieve, in this case, the objective of eventual control of the South China Sea. Now, there are many examples I could refer to, but of course, the most obvious one is the nine-dash line. Over years of visiting colleagues in Southeast Asia, attending conferences and events in Southeast Asia, time and again, I remember being in conference rooms and there's a stage and there's a panel, perhaps it's the Chinese ambassador or the consul, a representative of the Chinese government, of the PRC government, is sitting there, and someone in the audience, I have a particular memory of a good friend of mine, Hashim Jalal, whom some of you may know, who in some ways is one of the founders of the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, and really the source of the idea of the archipelagic principle. And Hashim, his legal expertise, you know, brilliant man, would stand up during the Q&A, and he would ask the question to the Chinese ambassador, let's say, just tell us what it means, the nine-dash line. We don't know what it means. You know, you haven't given us any sort of coordinates, longitude, in fact, not having done that, this is my, he would not be so impolite as to say this, but I would say that if I'm a fisherman, if I'm a Malaysian fisherman or a Vietnamese fisherman, and I want to fish in the South China Sea, I don't even know when I've crossed the line because there are no coordinates and there are blanks between the dashes, right? So here's Hashim begging for clarity. That's all he wants is clarity, right? And the Chinese ambassador would typically change the topic and would not answer the question. And I'll give you one other anecdotal evidence, if I could, without going into further detail, except to say that it's very advantageous in both directions to be ambiguous, remember, because of course, since no one really knows what the nine-dash line means, China can choose on a given occasion to ignore it. When China's negotiating with, let's say, the Philippines with regard to possible joint development, we've seen that develop over the last months or so. I'm not sure it'll go anywhere. But in those circumstances, China does not want to sort of emphasize the nine-dash line and say, by the way, you know, this is ours, because that's not going to serve joint development. On the other hand, on the other side of the China, South China Sea, if they want to justify, for example, harassing, whether it's Malaysian or Vietnamese or other, even Indonesian fishermen, then they will drag out the nine-dash line. Or they could drag it out. So you see the advantage. They've got it going for themselves in both directions. Ambiguity is valuable. In fact, a conversation that I had, and I'll end very soon, don't worry, a conversation that I had with a representative, an official of the People's Republic of China, in fact, in retrospect, the highest ranking such official that I have ever had a face-to-face conversation with. And I asked her Hashim's question. Why don't you tell us what the nine-dash line means? And the answer I got from this official was quite remarkable. The official said, and this is a direct quote, ambiguity is wonderful. Ambiguity is wonderful. And then went on to say, ambiguity is fun. And I'm thinking, well, maybe fun for you, but not fun for the fishermen in Southeast Asia. And frankly, in 2016, when the arbitral court basically delegitimated the nine-dash line under international law, ambiguity turned out not to be fun. It was not even legal. So I will end on that note. Well, I didn't talk about prolongation, so let me just say one thing with regard to prolongation. This is, of course, a matter of delay, and I think it goes without saying. It was in 1992 that ASEAN first suggested the idea of a code of conduct in the South China Sea. Now, next year, that will have been 30 years without any result. There are many reasons for that. And I don't want to underestimate the importance of the disunity in ASEAN. And actually, to be fair to ASEAN, let's go back even farther, right? Is there any region in the world that is more diverse than Southeast Asia? Historically, economically, culturally? Less so politically now, insofar as authoritarianism seems to be a more likely model, but still tremendous diversity. So there was already embedded in the character of the society across Southeast Asia, reasons for disagreement, reasons for differences, right? But of course, we know that China exacerbated those differences. China generated, I won't go through that history, you know it better than I, Phnom Penh, 2012, and so forth, generated what amounts to a proxy veto inside ASEAN in the form of Hun Sen, of a Cambodian government. There's just uncontrovertible evidence with regard to that. I think that just cannot be denied. So in other words, what I'm saying is that, and I could go on, there are many other instances where China has very, very cleverly, they're very smart and often very effective, very cleverly managed to prolong, delay the process of reaching a COC. And let me just say this at the very end, those of us, you have, I'm sure, many in the room, looked at the so-called draft negotiating text, will have noted that not only is the disagreement among Southeast Asian countries expressed in the margins of that document, as we see different countries putting in different phrases that they would like inserted in the agreement, which don't necessarily agree between themselves. But for example, one of the positions that China has taken in the margins of this draft agreement, as I understand, as I've read it anyway, or the margins at least, it seems to me quite clear that China would like the agreement, the COC, to say that only by unanimous consent of all the signatories, which would presumably be the 11 countries, the 10 in ASEAN plus the one in China, only by unanimous consent could any signatory, Malaysia, Vietnam, anybody who had signed the document, involve itself with an outside power for the purpose of extracting resources from the South China Sea, gas, oil, and so forth. Now, because the requirement would be unanimity, then obviously China would have a veto. China wouldn't even need to call on the Cambodian veto. They would already possess a veto to prevent that from happening. Now, this would lead to the point that I'm going to end on. What is all this about, really, going through all the detail and trying to sort it out into some larger picture? It's about the quest for strategic autonomy in Southeast Asia. That is the bottom line. And if that wording gets into the COC, then it will be in China's interest to no longer postpone the code, but to make it happen right away, because it will serve China's interest and its ultimate desire and goal, which again is to control the South China Sea. I hope that's provocative. I'm pretty sure it will be. Remember, I'm not demonizing China. We need China. The United States particularly needs to work with China. We need to get beyond this tit for tat back and forth, especially at a time when COVID-19 is wreaking havoc around the world. So I am not in any way, shape, or form an enemy of China. China is important, and China must be involved in any long-term solution of global affairs. But with regard to the South China Sea, my assertion that China wants control seems to me to be incontrovertible. And feel free to disagree and try to persuade me otherwise. I'd be happy to respond. Thank you for your listening, and apologies if in any way I offended anyone in the audience.